Brindy, Pick,
Akron.
Akron.
Uh-huh.
That was like a weirdly emotional game to Texas Tech. And then
it was kind of like Iowa State beating Kentucky.
Yeah.
And then they, I don't want to say laid an egg, but Tennessee was just the better team.
And then like when Alabama comes out and scores like that, and you could just tell Texas Tech didn't, they weren't ready for that game. My selection was North Carolina VCU. And again, we have no idea of whether or not it's going to be the right decision or not, but like that is a loss that made you change your entire program.
Yeah, because going into that game, I was like, well, you know, we lost our best player.
Correct.
And
but and there were good moments. Like, yeah,
year.
Exactly.
We Duke with Caleb Wilson, and then they blew that lead, and it's like, yeah, he's gone.
Correct.
He's got to go.
And so it's like that to me is like such a sliding doors moment. All right, based on this tournament, who are some guys you'd say stock up? Teams, people, anything?
Jerry McNamara?
I think that's a big one. There was one other coach, but I know.
Ryan Doty? He's going to Syracuse. He just the most obvious commitment. Who's the high point coach who was feeling himself?
God, Flynn.
I'm looking it up right now. Flynn Clayman.
Clayman, yeah. He definitely had a he is a wrestling promo. He also like that guy should coach defense on football. Like that guy's a defensive coordinator in a basketball mind.
Bennett Sturts.
I had another Iowa. And I know you've been high on him forever, so this isn't it's not like but
Ben McCollum?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a good Ben McCollum year.
For sure. And then to have his agent be like, yeah, we don't even want to talk to North Carolina. It's like, okay, gotcha. I love this time of year, though.
Last game notwithstanding, the way Tommy Lloyd publicly played North Carolina against Arizona is one of the finest like pieces of public leveraging I've ever seen.
You know who I'm, even though they lost and I thought they showed poorly, I'm kind of all in on Brad Underwood. His quote with, like, nowadays coaches just complain about everything. And when someone was, like, really trying to be like, you're playing Houston in Houston, he's like, I don't care. He's like, I was a JUCO coach. I'll play them on.
He's like,
wherever.
I've driven buses.
He's like, I drove vans. Yeah. I don't care. I'm just so happy to be here. I was like, okay.
I also thought another one in like that same vein, Rick Barnes, you know, he was asked about like, you know, like when everyone was just asking all the old coaches what they think about this world and then they would just pontificate. Rick was like, I love it. It's pretty simple. You ask like, hey, we like this guy. What's the number? Either you match the number or you don't, and then you coach the team. I was like, damn. Okay. Yeah. I'm with you, Rick. Stock down. This is probably too broad, but it's just like, is trying to win with freshmen back again? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's, are we at the point where it's like, you can have really good teams, but you're not going to win at all?
Well, I mean, look at the last 2 years for Duke. You had Cooper Flagg and Con Knipl, and I think five total guys who got drafted.
They had the guy also that went like whatever 14th.
Yeah,
Malawak.
Yeah, Malawak.
Malawak. That's right. You know, and they weren't all freshmen this year. Isaiah Evans is a sophomore. Gongba is a sophomore. Foster's, you know, a junior. I mean, is Shire stock down?
He's in this.
I think that's kind of.
He's at the point now where he's going to be fighting the narrative until he beats it.
It did feel like a little bit of cherry picking. It was like, oh, look at the leads they blew. I'm like, well, they just also came back against St. John's. Like, they don't need me to defend them, but I don't know. That was kind of impressive.
Well, and there's also just something about, like, you know, it's the problem with being Duke. It's like every time you lose, we can't wait to relive it.
Of course.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get into the list. Also coming up during the next hour, Wes Reynolds of VSiN is going to join the program. He will preview the Masters with us. We will talk, of course, about the North Carolina hiring when we come back, right here on Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Wes Reynolds of VSiN is going to join us during the next segment. We will preview the Masters. Of course, big day today. Of course, the Champions Dinner. All that going on down at Augusta National. Before we do that, let's get into the list. Michael Malone. Yes, of course, Tim, the news of yesterday was that North Carolina is hiring Michael Malone. But this was on the Pat McAfee show, and this was a live, real-time reaction with Coach K on the air. Here's what it sounded like. Coach K couldn't wait to get out of there. So he gets his one-liner in. I do think there's a couple of things here, Tim. I don't think this was the plan. It doesn't mean that it can't work. It does not mean that Michael Malone...
It was definitely not the plan.
But it was definitely not the plan. And I think what is interesting is how did they get to this position? Because it feels like, okay, they were pursuing Lloyd. He makes the decision to stay. And then Donovan tells them, this is according to Jeff Borzello, Donovan said that he would not leave until the end of the season. And because the portal, is it open today or is it tomorrow?
Today.
Portal opens today. North Carolina decides we have to make the move and we're moving now. But my question is like, how did you let it get to that point? Is it institutional arrogance? Is it you were pursuing? So like, if you knew time was going to be of the essence, how did you let it get here?
The Billy Donovan aspect of this whole thing confuses me. Like, and I've had Matt McCall on my show many times. I think he's really good at what he does. He worked under Billy Donovan, and he said this on, I think it was the Field of 68, that he's, you know, really loyal and won't turn his attention away from the NBA until the end of the season. And I'm like, is that true? They were out there losing by 40 this weekend. There's a week left. Like, no one, if Billy Donovan left Chicago yesterday to go to the UNC with a week left in their disastrous season, would anyone be like, quit on his team? Tell you what, that Billy Donovan, got to watch out for him. Like,
the only thing that I could think
Nick Saban quit on the Falcons middle of the year.
Petrino quit on the
Petrino,
Falcons.
Petrino. My fault.
Saban did finish the year with the Dolphins. Yeah. His deal was he just lied
and I'm not going
right,
to
he
Alabama.
Said, oh, do you need me to say it? Okay, I'm not going
to
be the coach at Alabama. That was his line.
That's what it was. Yeah, my fault. But Jeff Goodman reported it yesterday that the new AD panicked. That was what he had heard. That is what he reported. So, and to your point, Michael Malone might do really well. And to what you were discussing with Rick Barnes just a little while ago, like, Rick Barnes kind of told it how it is. It's totally different. You don't have to slide into the DMs of 14-year-olds anymore. Now you could just be like, we've got $2 million for you. Are you coming or not? Okay. You're not? All right, we're on to our next list. If you have a good GM and a good talent evaluator, you could almost do your job as just coach and hoop.
I think the other thing, though, is like, this is where I kind of find myself like going, man, like talking myself in circles a little bit, but do I think Michael Malone's a better coach than Billy Donovan? I do. Billy Donovan, I know, has two national titles, and I know that Billy Donovan's great, but like Billy Donovan had Kevin Durant, had, you know, I mean, Russell Westbrook, like that, what was that team? Ibaka. Now, granted, they were going up against the Warriors, but I mean, they had a lead twice in game 6 and game 7, couldn't convert it, and like that would have been a title winning team. Michael Malone has a title. Like, Michael Malone, like with the Kings, did a good job and then gets weirdly fired there. Like, do I think in terms of pure basketball acumen that he's a better coach? I do. There's just the weird college basketball of it all, which is it the same thing?
And I don't know.
Because on the one hand, I guess you could make this argument. If everything is year to year, and really all it comes down to is can you coach up a team for this year. Maybe the downsides of Malone, which is difficult to work with, maybe not like the greatest with people. Maybe that's not enough time for it to like grate on you. You know what I mean?
And I think it was Hurley who said it. The best players like to be coached hard. Like, there's some hard-ass coaches, and Hurley's one of them.
And I'm also flagging.
Doesn't seem to be affecting him, right?
I'm also flagging. I think there might be an opportunity. You're gonna have to. You probably can't physically abuse them.
Yeah, that you cannot do.
Probably can't choke a guy on camera. I think there is an opportunity for the tough coach to kind of have a renaissance here.
Well, we just spent the first segment on the show talking about Dan Hurley. He ain't a soft coach.
No, I also think Hurley has an unfair advantage.
I don't think Rick Pitino is a soft coach.
No, he's certainly not. But I think the thing about Hurley is if you sign up for Hurley, you know what you're getting.
Sure.
And so it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like the
and
guys
I don't
that
think
he,
those guys, like, I think the new age tough coach, he's not Bob Knight. Like, Bob Knight looked like he was just nothing can ever make him happy. Like, Hurley, you could see, like, even when, who was it? Was it Solo Ball who banked in the three last night late in the game to kind of deficit? And he, like, looked at him and, like, smiled, like, nice. You know, like, there clearly are moments with Hurley where I'm sure his practices are hell. But I got to imagine there are moments with Hurley that are gratifying. I don't know if that ever happened with Bob Knight. It was like, I just have to get through 4 years and then it's going to make me a tougher human.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like the other problem with Knight is Knight's career was so long that it probably is like, is Bob Knight the same coach in 1994 that he was in 1978?
No.
You know what I mean? Like, he does have guys that talk about him with reverence.
Oh, sure. There's a ton of guys that talk about him very highly. I mean, heck. And Coach K spoke highly of him, right?
Well, that one's always the... That's always the interesting one. My working theory is that... I mean, there's obviously two egomaniacs. But my theory is that Knight didn't like that... K was maybe playing a little looser with the rules than Knight believed in.
Mm.
I mean, that's why Knight never respected Wooden. I mean, I don't know. I also think the problem with Knight and Krzyzewski is, like, it's what happens when, like, basically the same person is in a competitive field. Like, Coach K is a more palatable Bob Knight.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
But, like, the thing with Malone, like, to your point about, you know, with the AD panicking, or Goodman's point to the AD panicking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like you'd do a lot worse than panicking and getting an NBA champion head coach who, look, when they won the title, it was like, dude, this guy is the best coach in all of basketball.
Yeah, and we do that in the NBA. I mean, we went with the Nick Nurse. Remember Nick Nurse?
I was just about to say Nick Nurse. Yeah,
I knew when that guy showed up. They were doing the half, or the like, the locker room look in, and he was wearing a hat with his own initials on it, like a golfer. I was like, I'm out on this guy. No, thank you. You guys can have him, but I don't know. Krzyzewski ended up making a larger, broader point in which North Carolina's clear approach, for better or worse, is turning to a professional model. They got a professional coach in football, and they got a professional coach in basketball. I'm at least intrigued, right?
I'm more intrigued by Malone than I was Belichick. Belichick, I was like, this seems like a disaster.
Yes, we were talking through this in real time yesterday. The problem is when you kind of walk it out, it rhymes. I think that this was also a signal that Michael Malone did not feel either A, the NBA jobs that were going to be available, he was not interested in, or B, the NBA was maybe not as interested in him. So the same thing happens with Belichick. Belichick would rather be coaching in the NFL, but there weren't teams. And so North Carolina...
He wanted the Falcons job, and correct. They didn't want him. I would say, ask the question. Michael Malone reached the mountaintop and knew what it tasted like to have a generational superstar in Nikola Jokic in the NBA. And are you willing to go to the... I don't know. I'm trying to think of who was interested, because there was reports that there was a team interested. I can't remember who it was. But, like, do you want to go to Portland?
Do you want to go to New Orleans?
New Orleans, right? Or would you rather go get the same amount of money at North Carolina? You're living in an amazing location. You're doing all the things that... I mean, UNC is a one-of-one job, right? Or not one-of-one. One of... five, one of 10 job in college basketball. You're flying private. You're going five star. I mean, you're basically in the NBA at UNC. There's nothing about UNC that screams college. You got Jordan Brand. You got all the money you could ask for. You got a huge arena. You're staying at the best places. You've got the best food. You're living the NBA lifestyle. And if you're Michael Malone, to George's point, do I want to go to New Orleans, play in front of no fans every night, and we suck and have no hope? Or do I go to UNC where I could get a new roster every year?
Well, I also think there's a couple of other things to your, you know, to expand on your point. Also, what we've seen is the last couple of hires, with the exception of the Knicks, who went and got Mike Brown, almost everyone else that had an opening filled that opening with someone that was either like a developmental guy or somebody that was part of like their G League. There had been clearly like a player development emphasis. And then furthermore, I got to think with a lot of these NBA jobs that were cycling through coaches, I started to wonder, like, what about the money? Like, in the end, I guarantee you North Carolina is going to pay him close to top dollar. Are we sure that that's what the NBA would have gotten? Because if you're going to sit there and cycle through coaches, do you really want to pay $10 to $15 million a year?
To bring this back to Billy Donovan, Billy Donovan, if he was the candidate that UNC wanted, which I am going to trust Jeff Goodman, he's usually pretty piped in, he has maybe made... Now, look, Billy Donovan, I would very much like to have his bank account, but he has made two really bad decisions in his career. He left the Thunder because he didn't want to rebuild. He left the Thunder to go to the Bulls when he had basically everything that he could have asked for it in OKC. Like, Dagnall was his guy. He brought in to run the G League. And he left to go to the Bulls, and now he wouldn't leave the Bulls to go to North Carolina?
The only thing I can think of is there a little bit more to that last detail, which is, if he left this week, is there some type of punishment?
Maybe.
Financial?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, there might be some stuff that we don't know.
Because I don't, like, to me, it's almost like, I'm with you. It's
and
like,
the Bulls apparently are all in on him, right? Like, I think it was, I mean, kind they of fired his doing to fire him.
They fired everybody else. Right. And maybe that's what maybe he really wasn't that interested in North Carolina. Maybe it's the simplest answer. Remember when his name first came up and we were talking, like, why would he, who left college basketball over a decade ago because he didn't like where it was going, why would he go back into that universe? Maybe he just saw an opportunity with the North Carolina opening. Hey, there's people in this organization. I don't want him here. And he used it as leverage against the Bulls. Like, maybe he never really wanted to go.
That, I mean, could also be true.
Yeah, there's that. And I was with Gabe yesterday. Jeffrey, did you hear we broke down that Bulls front office, how purely inept they've been at making trades? Out of their recent deals to tear down that team, do you know how many first-round selections that they have?
That would be donut.
Zero. Goose egg. And we're talking trades of DeMar DeRozan, Zach LaVine, Nikola Vucevic, Ayo Dosunmu just this trade deadline, and they have no first round selections out of that.
The only hesitation I have is I'm always unclear how much of that is bad management versus you work for Jerry Reinsdorf. Like a man that stated on the record, like he believes in the value of being in the play-in. And so you're always just going to end up making moves that make you 41-41.
Right.
Or 42-40 or 40-42. Like you're on that precipice. That's the only question that I would like to have. But
it isn't like they've gotten players back. Because I look at the team now and it's not like they're in great shape.
No.
I wonder if there's some weird language in Donovan's most recent extension, which kicked in this season.
Yes, that he signed last, wasn't in the summer.
Yep.
That was my other instinct, is that there was something contractual. But I would also argue that's on North Carolina. Like, Jim Tanner has every connection in the entire world of basketball. I guarantee you he doesn't have to make that many phone calls to find out what's in that, to find out what's in that contract. Like, it just feels to me like maybe I don't know whether it was arrogance, because sometimes you can come across looking arrogant, but really you got played. Do we think maybe it was just in the end they thought they had Tommy Lloyd?
Or Dusty May. Or one of the main figures at the final.
And before everyone wants to kill North Carolina, and I swear I'm just telling everyone how this works. Agents will make you believe you have someone. That's how they create leverage. That's sure. How they do their job. I mean, I remember once upon a time when Mike Norvell left Memphis, Arkansas, Ole Miss, and Florida State all thought they had Mike Norvell. One school got him. I know you find that hard to believe. That's kind of where I just always struggle, is like how much of it was a leverage play. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, let's preview the Masters. Wes Reynolds of VSiN is going to do that with us. Nobody better on golf. Get your Masters picks and preview coming up next right here on Jeff Wright & Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Wes Reynolds is a golf columnist as well as an NFL and college football contributor to VSiN. You can also hear him on the Live Bet Saturday program as well as the Live Bet Sunday program, airing from noon until 6 on Saturdays right here in the Central Time Zone and noon until 7 on Sundays. This podcast is also the Long Shots Golf Podcast. He's on the Everything app at Wes Reynolds 1. Wes, before we start taking a look into specific names, what are some of the things that you consider about the Masters when you start to kind of sort through who you want to really look at? Do you care about tee times? We got tee times today. Do you care about guys that start early on Thursday, late on Friday? Do you take a look at the weather? What are the things that you look at?
Well, I think you do obviously take a look at the weather, and the weather, not much to it doesn't look like this week, except Thursday the wind's going to blow, I think, a little bit harder than it will on the weekend. But haven't had a lot of rain down there in Augusta. The course will be watered plenty because they want to maintain that those beautiful picturesque sightings that we have on the telecast for all of us. But it's going to be firm and fast. That's usually how Augusta plays. It's a big golf course, you know, high 7,500-yard marks. So I think in terms of stats, you know, you got to get it out there a little bit off the tee. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to be the ultimate bomber, but you got to be able to get it out there. You got to take advantage of the par fives. Most of your scoring in terms of under par is going to be on the par fives. It's been very pronounced, especially the last several years with the quality of player that has won. So you got to look at the par five scoring, distance. I think you also got to look a little bit more at around the green play as well, scrambling, because these greens are firm and fast and they're going to roll pretty quick on the stint meter over the weekend. So you'll have some of these shots that are really good second shots, really good approach shots, and they won't hold the green. So you're going to have to pitch and you're going to have to chip a little bit from them tight lies around the green and really scramble to make par, potentially chip in for birdie. So those are kind of the stats I really look at when I'm looking at trying to find a Masters winner here.
Wes Reynolds joining us here on the program, my colleague from VSiN. And as Jeffrey mentioned, make sure you check out the Long Shots podcast, which I believe they will be hitting record in about 25 minutes. So I'll let Wes run here in just a minute. But Wes, it's hard to start talking golf and especially the Masters without leading with Scottie Scheffler. You know, how would you describe his current form? I know that he just had his second kid, so he didn't play last week. He is a two-time champ. So what are you expecting from Scottie Scheffler, and how would you, as a bettor, go about betting Scottie Scheffler this week?
Well, I did not bet him to win this week, and he certainly can. You know, if it follows the pattern, Tim, it's going to be even-numbered years, 2022, 2024, and now 2026, and he gets his third green jacket. But he's been a little bit off this year, and it's not like he's played poorly necessarily. He already does have a win, and, you know, he's never missing a cut. He never, like, really plays horribly. But there's a couple things where he's gone down, and keep in mind, these were historic numbers that he had last year. This season on the PGA Tour, number one, he ranked 80th on strokes gained approach, and that's obviously your iron play. He's led the planet, basically, for the last three seasons in that category, so you feel like he's going to figure it out at some point. But where he's really kind of struggled this year, and last year, keep in mind, he led for round one, round two, round three, and round four scoring average. In round one this year on the PGA Tour, he is 96th. He is three shots worse than he shot for his average opening round last year. So he's been getting off to these slow starts. You know, he's still got the win equity to, I think, be the justifiable favorite, but he hasn't certainly been at his peak this year.
Yeah, along the lines of Scottie, because this is something that I've struggled with, where I do wonder if we're being overly critical, but the number that's been a little alarming that you point out is the iron play. And it's like, how do you balance the fact that, like, we're just used to seeing him win everything, and it's like, all right, it's his worst finish this year, I think, is what, 24th at the Arnold Palmer? And then he still has a win. But, like, how do you balance all that? Because we are also talking about what made him the greatest player of the last 5 years, which is the iron play. Like, how do you balance what to really factor in? Because you can also talk yourself into, he's going to show up at Augusta. It requires hard golf shots. He has all the shots. Like, how you really just leave him on the table? That's kind of where I struggle.
No, I know, and I completely understand it. And he still has the fear factor. You know, it might not be as pronounced as it was last year when he was dominating, but it's still there. But I need to see maybe a little bit more. And I think he's a guy you're going to trust to figure it out at some point. But he hasn't come in, I think, really at his peak. Now, maybe he has the nabby factor with little Remy coming along, and sometimes you see a guy when they have a kid or they get engaged or get married, and then all of a sudden they're in that good frame of mind, right?
A little extra perspective.
Exactly. And you see some of those guys play really well, you know, once a seminal event in their life happens off the course. So he could certainly do it. I don't know how I'm playing him this week. I'm not playing him for an outright, even though I think like 6-1 is probably a fair price when you look at it in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, I'm sure you could play him in top tens or play him in some kind of way and make a little bit of money off him. But he is not my pick to win this week.
All right, Wes, tonight they will be serving a Wagyu filet mignon, some seared salmon, a little sticky coffee pudding.
Toffee,
excuse me. Apologies. I did appreciate the quote from Rory earlier today. People keep asking me why you didn't go more Irish, and I say, well, I want to enjoy the dinner as well. So, well done by Rory.
Tim, you missed the biggest upset. And, Wes, I don't know if you caught on this, but as a Rory stan, I'm used to every time he posts what he's drinking on the airplane after a win, I immediately go look up the cost of the wine. His white Bordeaux costs more than his red wine. That was the biggest upset to me.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the people expected, because he was Irish, that, okay, it's going to be like corned beef and cabbage or something,
yep.
You know?
Haggis, no. Not Scottish, I guess, yeah.
Yes, you know, but no, it's a very good menu, probably one of the better ones that we've had. And then you look at Rory coming in here. He tweaked the back at the Arnold Palmer. a couple weeks ago, and then he withdrew before Saturday's round, and then didn't really play that well at the Players. And we haven't seen a guy defend at the Masters since Tiger did it, I think, in 2002.
Yep.
And there's a reason why, because you have that Champions Dinner, you have all the media, and plus the fact of what that Masters did, where he clinched the career Grand Slam. That was the first time since Gene Sarazen, I believe, in 1935. So 90 years he had accomplished something that had. So there's a little bit of that, oh, man, I finally did it. You know, I've been chasing this thing for over a decade, and I finally did it. And he's gone on to win an event since and play well, but his peak necessarily right now. And, you know, I'm not fading him, but I'm not backing him either. I just think that that's a lot. And there's a reason why you don't see these guys go back to back.
No, I mean, along the same lines, it's like I was able to win a couple of Players pools by not taking Scotty and then, you know, fading Rory a little bit. And it's like, you do wonder, like, at a certain time, is this like hitting on 17 every single time? Like, am I tempting fate by just leaving them off of every pool?
I mean, look, you could maybe use him if you're going to use like a one and done. I mean, certainly you want to use the tippy top player here at the Masters. Like, this is not one you want to gamble. So you want to use a Scotty, a Rory, a John Rahm, a Bryce. Play. You want to use one of the chalky guys here because this is the event you save them for.
You know, Wes, as we look at the two guys high atop the odds board, both LIV guys, John Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau, you just mentioned Rahm. Are those, you know, the podcast that you do over at Visa is called Long Shots, so you guys like to take those bombs, but historically speaking, bombs don't necessarily hit at the Masters, right? It tends to be guys closer to the top of the odds board. I think Hideki Matsuyama, when he won, was maybe in that 40-1 range or something like that. So when you look at, let's just lump the top five guys. We talk Scheffler, we talk Rory. What about Rahm, DeChambeau, and Ludvig Åberg? What are you expecting from those guys?
Yeah, and Tim, you're right. You don't want to go, I think, too bomb heavy on this because it's usually a class player. Look at the prices in recent years. Like Rory was plus 650. Scotty was 4-1. Rahm was like, I think 9-1 or somewhere in the single digits. So speaking of Rahm, he is one that I did play this week. And, you know, there's that worry that he's been playing half all over the world on LIV, like in the middle of the night in South Africa and in Australia. And, you know, that maybe he's not as battle tested coming in here. But if you look at his form line of the five starts he's made this year, second, first, fifth, and second, that is an average finish of 2.4. So he's obviously, his game is in very good shape. He comes in now with a victory this year. And I think he's got a little chip on his shoulder where it's kind of like, hey, remember me? You know, I'm still a factor in this game. And I think he's more at peace now because when he first came back and joined LIV and he was defending Masters champion, he was, I think, having misgivings and having some second thoughts of, did I make the right decision? And you saw it in his play where he finished, I think, like 45th or something. This year, I think that's off a little bit. Now he's like, okay, I've got a little bit of something to prove that I'm one of the best in the game. And there's always been that little untold rivalry of him and Rory of who's the best European player. And Rahm has that savvy in him. You know, he has that killer in him and that fight in him. And I think he's going to play very well this week. Bryson certainly could play well. He's already won this season, and he did finally contend last year at this thing. He was in that final pairing with Rory, of course, kind of fell apart for him on the back nine. And speaking of falling apart, that's what Ludvig Åberg has really been doing in these big events, like at the Players Championship. He's got a 3-shot lead at the turn on Saturday, or Sunday rather. And then just the driver just went awry and he hit a couple in the water. And you saw it last week at the Valero too. He looked like, okay, he's going to pull away and win this thing. And then he couldn't hit a fairway. So that's my concern with Ludvig. Keep in mind, he was one shot off the lead last year that Rory and Justin Rose held at the time with two holes to play. He goes bogey, triple bogey on his Sunday finish. So there's something there that Ludvig's got to get over, that mental hurdle, I think, in terms of being able to finish one of these big events off.
Speaking of Rose, I think he's been mentioning the fact that 8 times, I believe, previously, someone that finished runner-up return to win the Masters. He is 41 years old, so maybe doesn't fit the age profile, but this is a guy that has played this golf course exceptionally well and he's really found some form the last 18 months. How do you look at him?
Yeah, I guess you got to bet him for first round leader, right? Considering he's either led or co-led several times, you know, so it's like, okay, just, you know, that almost looks too easy. And then before you know it, he's leading after 18 holes on Thursday night. But
the Charlie Hoffman Memorial first round bet.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. Yes. But about Rose, even though he's in his 40s, he can still get it out there a little bit off the tee. He's got some power. He's certainly got the experience. He's got one of the best resumes to have never won here. Of course, he, you know, his fate, he's lost two playoffs at the Masters, including last year to Rory and then to Sergio several years ago. But you look at this guy, he's the ultimate banker, I think, for a placement market finish. 20 appearances, 17 made cuts here, 12 times in the top 20. So I think that that's one, if you play placement markets, if you play top 10s, top 20s, top 30s, he's certainly in that middle, that top 20, top 30, I think an absolute play.
All right, Wes, before we let you kind of just pepper around the board, a guy that has been mentioned a bunch this year, I believe he has a win, but historically hasn't maybe fared all that great at the Masters, is Matt Fitzpatrick. He has won, you know, the U.S. Open, but you look at his finishes, tied for 7th in 2016, tied for 10th in 2023. He always makes the cut, but is Matt Fitzpatrick someone you're looking at here this week?
Yeah, he is, and I think this is the year where he finally contends. He's got some good finishes here, but you're right, Tim. He's never been there right at the end, but he showed a lot of resilience because he thought he was going to have that Players' Championship won, and then Cameron Young just kind of snatched it from him on the last couple holes. But if you look at Fitz, how he's hitting the ball, he's third tee to green, he's seventh on approach, seventh total, 19th off the tee. The putting's a little bit down, but it's gotten better. I think a lot of those putting numbers are deceiving because he putted poorly on that West Coast where he doesn't play a lot out there. Now back in Florida, kind of more familiar with these greens in the East. He's playing the best golf he's played in some years. Remember, he won the U.S. Open a few years ago at Brookline. And I think he's kind of been slowly working his way back. He had a lot of caddy changes, had some equipment changes. Now things seem to be fine. I think Fitz is going to surprise some people this week.
Speaking of Cameron Young, what do you make of him? Because I felt like after the Players, and I get it, it's a big event, and we always immediately turn our attention to Augusta, but I think deservedly so. Everyone had kind of turned their attention of, hey, this is a guy that makes sense at Augusta. Do you feel the same way?
I do, and maybe we're going to go three in a row with Scotty, Rory, and perhaps Cameron Young to win the Players and the Masters in the same year. And Cameron Young, I think, you know, when he finally got that maiden at the Wyndham and they played so well at the Ryder Cup for a defeated U.S. team, I think he's got the confidence now, and he finally won that big event. And we thought he was going to maybe win one this year, and it turns out it's the Players so far, but also third at the API, seventh at the Genesis. He's got six major top tens in the last 4 years, so he has contended in majors before. I feel like this is the time, maybe this one, perhaps the U.S. Open, but one of the majors this year, I think Cameron Young is going to win a major, and it could be this one this week.
What about Akshay? You know, are we bringing back the lefties? I mean, it is always tough to sit there and go, do I really trust the guy with the broomstick? But Adam Scott got one of these.
Yeah, he would be maybe my long shot this week. And, you know, long shots are relative term because I'm not playing 300 and 400 right to ones because they don't win this thing. But Akshay does have a big win at the Arnold Palmer when he chased down Daniel Berger on the back nine and won it in the playoff. Eighth on approach, 10th in putting. He probably made a little bit of a mistake going and playing that Indian Open over there on the DP World Tour where he missed the cut. But he's, you know, he's a lefty. He's kind of like Bubba Watson, where he hits it a little bit all over the place, but he can take different angles at the pins that a lot of other players can't take, and he's very creative, and especially around the green. He's a guy like in the mid-60s that if there is a long shot, I think that's where you'd probably want to look.
Who do you like the most this week?
If I had to go one, I'd probably go Rahm, but Rahm and Cameron Young, I felt, were my two best. I also put a little on Patrick Reed, who is now back playing on the DP World Tour. He'll be on the PGA Tour late in August. But Patrick Reed is a guy, he doesn't dazzle you statistically, but he knows how to get around this place. And even when he's not playing well, like you saw him last year, finished third, it's like, there he is. You know, he's always kind of there on that first page of the leaderboard lurking. So Patrick Reed might be a good mid-range price, around 40-ish to one or so.
Are we going to get Lady Justine back in the mix? Like, do you think we'll use Golf Facts show up now that he's left LIV?
I think probably so.
I hope so. You know, God, I hope so. I miss her.
He's won twice already on the DP World Tour this year, so he's back playing well. He's saying all the right things. He's going to be back full-time, I think, next year. So, you know, he wants to play against the best, and the best right now is on the PGA Tour.
Wes, you're great to join us. We really appreciate your time, my man.
Thank you, fellas. Appreciate it.
That's Wes Reynolds of VSiN.
Where does the Masters for you, Jeffrey, amongst all sporting events, how high is it for you?
Oh,
like,
God.
Just, I'm talking about, like,
yeah, I know,
how geeked up you get, right?
I mean, there's obviously the Masters is more than a golf tournament in the sense that, like, it's kind of the signal of, all right, we can all go outside. You know what I mean? Like, there's
it's Punxsutawney Phil.
Correct. Like, it is like the kind of the beginning. And so it's always right after the Final Four, and it gets into like a great stretch of sports where we mentioned the NBA playoffs, NHL playoffs. Like, you get into these modes. I used to always, my favorite golf tournament used to be the U.S. Open. But now that the U.S. Open is largely been neutered for several reasons. Number one, we refuse to change the equipment and we let these guys act like that they're bigger, stronger, and faster when no, they have a golf ball that doesn't spin in a basically a shovel on the head of a driver so they can hit it really long ways. It's pretty awesome, man. It typically always delivers, and there's always going to be an emotional connection because it's the same golf course every single year. Sure. And you know, you can think about all these big moments, and they're usually, it feels like it's the golf tournament you sit around and watch with your family the most. I would say it's probably in my top five.
Yeah, I would have guessed that. It was pretty high up there. And for me, like, you're much more into golf than I am. It's appointment viewing for me, especially Sunday. You know, it is, you just have to watch it, right? You have to wrap up your Sunday watching it. So yeah, it's the Super Bowl of golf. It's kind of odd that it is so early, but I think that's,
it's a lot like NASCAR in the sense that, like, what are you doing? You put it, but the difference, I guess, would be with golf, the PGA Tour doesn't own any of the majors, and so they're kind of at the mercy of whenever Augusta says, and Augusta probably has more power than they do. If, like, they announce we're having the tournament here, everyone else has to follow. I think the other thing that really helps the Masters is on the second nine, you have so much risk-reward that you can see collapses, but then you can also see guys go out and get it. Like when Phil goes and gets his first, you know, major, he shoots 31 on the back, but then, you know, you have the Jordan Spieth getting a quad on 12 10 years ago, and Rory seemingly blowing it and then coming back and then blowing it again and then coming back and blowing it again and somehow still winning. Like, it has the built-in drama that not a lot of the other golf tournaments consistently deliver.
So it was funny. I was watching something on Netflix, and the new season of Full Swing was being promoted. And I didn't even finish last season. I just wasn't super into it. I can't wait to watch the Masters breakdown, but my worry.
Well, you
got to
watch, you know, over on
is Prime. Rory not in it?
Well, you got to watch. Prime did a recap of Rory's.
Okay.
Like, they did like a special documentary, and then also Rory over on YouTube, the Masters has him going hole by hole with his final round. That's really good too.
By the way, we have some news. We were just talking about Michael Malone and his salary. This first reported by Brian Murphy, and Thamel has confirmed it. Michael Malone is set to make $8.3 million per year on a six-year deal. That projects to put him just behind Bill Self as the second highest paid coach in basketball, college basketball. So, to our point, it was like, okay, what's he going to get paid in the NBA versus lifestyle? He's not going to have Nikola Jokic wherever he goes next. And do you just go to UNC and get, I believe it was, I think the six-year deal is $50 million guaranteed.
Well, and then, like, there's the other question, which is, you know, Myron Metcalf wrote this in his story over at ESPN. He wrote the following. With the Nuggets, Malone had three-time MVP, Nikola Jokic to build a championship roster around. Tar Heels don't have the same level of brand power they once had to attract the best players, and it's also unclear whether they'll have the budget. Those are constraints Malone could face when he takes the job. Like, I do think that's kind of the what I keep getting at the larger picture is I care less about what you spend on your coach, what you spend on your planes and whatnot. It's like, what did you spend on the roster? That's what matters the most to me. And it's just, do I think North Carolina is going to be going in with a empty pocketbook? No, but it's like, are we sure that they're fighting at the same level that, I mean, are we really going to ignore the fact that the Big Ten now has the football national champion, the men's and women's basketball national champion?
And maybe the hockey?
It seems likely. I think they're the favorite right now, right?
Yeah, they got two teams, two out of the four coming to town, Wisconsin and Michigan.
I mean, like, are we just going to ignore that? And the ACC, like, even with Duke, like, they've not been good at the highest level.
I mean, Duke is the exception to that whole league. I mean, look at it right now. And I think UNC, I mean, it's a big what if Caleb Wilson doesn't get hurt, what's the peak of UNC? I don't know. I mean, they beat Duke. It was a big comeback, but they beat Duke. Virginia seems to be maybe on the rise again with Ryan Odom, but, you know, Tennessee, I thought, took care of business there.
And, like, Louisville's interesting-ish.
Yeah. Not a big Kelsey guy, but I get it. They got resources. But, yeah, I mean, and look, Will Wade's a different beast. I'm not going to say leaving NC State for LSU is a black eye for the league, but you did have a coach leave for the SEC.
Well, I mean, having you have more coaches that get fired than you do that are like having success right now.
Well, and even in that league, I mean, you have a Pitt who was like, "Meh, I guess we'll just run it back with Jeff Capel."
Well, I'm just I think Jeff Capel's blackmail folder is the greatest blackmail folder in the history of the world. Like, there's no telling what is in there. Regardless of your home's condition, my friend Josh Hysall is willing to make you a cash offer for the full market value. We've all blown off a maintenance project, maybe more than one. It doesn't matter if your home is beat up, Josh will still buy it. Rodney did just that when he inherited a home in Memphis and he contacted Josh. In his own words, the house was in bad shape. Josh told him not to worry. He'd appraise it and let Rodney know what his home was worth, and he'd write him a check. It was simply that easy. Josh made him a cash offer in less than 48 hours, and Rodney didn't have to worry about making any of the repairs, being inconvenienced by open houses. He didn't have to worry at all. Whether it's with a cash offer or selling the traditional way, Josh Hysall is dedicated to selling your home and doing so easy. Again, he's going to give you that guaranteed instant cash offer at the full market value for your home. You get the same convenience as other cash offers, but you walk away with more money in your pocket. He'll even give you a little bit extra time if you need it. You won't be rushed. You'll have up to 4 months before you hand over the keys.